Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'm joined by John Ellidge, Editor of City Metric, and Stephen Bush, Editor of The Staggers, to talk about the centrepiece of the Tory manifesto, a new right to buy policy. Then Stephen and I catch up on what he found out on the campaign trail in Wales. The centrepiece of the Tory manifesto launched this week was a promise to extend right to buy to tenants of housing association homes. John Ellidge, our editor of City Metric, joins us to tell us why he thinks it's a bad idea. And also in the studio, I call it studio, it's a broom cupboard, is Stephen Bush, editor of The Staggers. John, first of all, tell us about the policy, the original policy, the classic right to buy in the 1980s. Very popular, Thatcher's dream of a home, property-owning democracy. What were the downsides of it?
Well, it was an incredibly popular policy, as you say, because for, you know, quite clear political reasons that if basically giving homes to tenants at a discount is going to be popular with those tenants. So they're not only going to be feeling better disposed towards the government that did this, they're also, you know, in the long term, they become homeowners, and homeowners are disproportionately likely to vote Conservative. And then there's the theoretical arguments that it's aspirational. It's kind of helping people out who previously would have found it difficult to get on the housing ladder, perhaps. It's kind of giving them something back. So it's really not hard to see why the original was so popular, or, you know, why the Conservatives, in a sort of pre-election panic might maybe want to revive it. However, there was a pretty significant downside, which is that the money that was brought in by the sales, there was actually a rule, I think, that you not only was it not spent on replacement housing stock, there was actually a rule that said you couldn't spend it on replacement housing stock. So it undermined the social housing sector. That was probably fine in the 1980s, partly, you know, the Conservatives are ideologically against social housing, so they weren't too bothered. But also in the 1980s, it looked like we had enough housing. Now it's very clear that we don't have enough housing, and the sort of collapse in public sector house building rates that followed right to buy is a major contributor to that. So it's, except from the sort of most nakedly political stance, it's really difficult to see why the Conservatives would go back to this policy.
One of the things I find most striking is the fact that I think that a third of properties bought under right to buy are now rented out. So what you've effectively done is you've given people a productive asset rather than a home in those cases, which is one of the things that we always talk about in housing policy. We've been encouraged to kind of more and more see our homes as something in which you invest value. It's a sort of safe haven for your stock rather than, or, you know, or something that you can become a renter out to other people and make a profit from. Well,
yeah, indeed. I mean, if you imagine someone living in a free bed housing association property in London, would probably set you back, you know, £600,000 potentially. That's almost sort of winning the lottery levels. If you kind of are basically being given that at a 70% discount, and you can kind of, you can totally see people thinking, well, this is brilliant. Now I'm going to sort of move to the seaside like I always wanted to or something. And it ends up in the hands of a buy-to-let investor. There are so many horrible things about this policy that I almost don't know where to begin. But I think one of the strangest aspects of it is that, unlike council properties, housing association properties are not actually owned by the state.
Well, this is something I wanted to pick up, because it's very hard to order a non-profit organisation, that is an independent organisation, to sell off possibly in contravention of its charter, essentially, sell off stuff at below market rates, isn't it? I mean, how are they? What mechanism are they going to physically force housing associations to do this by?
Nobody seems clear at this point. Last time I looked into this, the National Housing Federation, which is the body that represents housing associations, said they had absolutely no idea. I think the consensus is that, you know, the government has enough sort of financial and political levers, they will be able to find a way of doing this. But there will be a lot of legal wrangling. There's going to be bills that come attached to that. The housing associations have already said they're going to fight this in the courts. There are estimates for the cost of this policy running into the billions, and it's just a bit mystifying that we do have an enormous housing crisis in this country. If you're going to spend billions on housing, why would you spend it on this as opposed to, you know,
building more bloody houses. TM, and I think that's probably 50p I have to put in your kind of copyright box there. Stephen, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the politics of this policy. It was received as if by the political class as a sort of, Margaret Thatcher, you know, kind of choirs of angels swelling around. You know, this is kind of a, for people who really love Margaret Thatcher, this was a kind of a weepy moment, like a sort of nostalgia concert, wasn't it? But do you think it's actually a policy that still commands widespread support in any particular section of society, apart from people who benefit from it directly, who I imagine are probably pretty pro?
I think the thing is, it's not just the Margaret Thatcher. I think, you know, it is important not to underestimate the value of something which did allow people who otherwise would have been stuck on a waiting list for years going, I'd quite like to downsize and move somewhere sunny now I've got old, having the ability to buy up and then sell and be able to move to the coast in their twilight years is not a small thing, and is actually something that, if you do it in a sort of a more progressive way, so you sell it as a leasehold, so it can only, yeah, we wouldn't let someone buy a business and then go, I'll only pay business rates instead of rent, ka-ching, I'll live in this house. And we don't do that for a variety of reasons. So there are important policy levers which are different, but I think in the same way that a certain type, you can always get a cheer in a Labour crowd by going, who's NHS, our NHS. Right to buy is an applause line for the Conservatives because they understand it as a time when they took a large chunk of Labour's base, they won seats that they had never won before and they would never have expected to win, and people are still grateful. People of a certain age will go, yeah, thank goodness for Maggie Thatcher. I was able to buy my house because of her. My gran was able to move out and go to Clacton, Southend, because of her. The big difference is that, exactly as John says, the housing need is completely different now. We forget that even in the late 90s, the Labour government was knocking down condemned council housing that no one wanted and renovating its existing stock. This idea that, less than a decade on, everyone would be going, oh God, we need more social housing, was completely remote. It is a solution to a problem of the 1980s. The slightly sinister element of it, with the housing association suing, is the government is also gently undermining judicial review. So they are actually making it much harder for the housing associations to go, actually, no, you can't take this from me.
Well, I'm sure this is something that we'll come back to, as housing is one of the issues I know that most exercises the New Statesman office, but for the moment I'll say thank you very much to John and Stephen. I'm joined by Staggers editor Stephen Bush, who has recently returned from 4 days on the campaign trail in Wales. Stephen, first of all, so tell us where you went, first of all, and then what you found.
So I went on a fairly circuitous.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And then I took the train until I crossed the border, then I got off at Newport and talked to some people, took it a bit further, stopped at Cardiff, went round. They have, Cardiff, we think of Wales as a Labour stronghold, but Cardiff actually is full of sort of various marginals. Cardiff North, which has backed the winner in every election since the year dot. Cardiff Central, which is one of those wonderfully volatile seats, and since 1992, basically every major party's had a go, and is now a straight fight between a very well dug in Liberal and a Labour came, and then the Vale of Glamorgan, which is mainly the Vale itself and Barry Island of Gavin and Stacey fame.
I've been to Barry Island as a child. That's what we did, because I grew up in Worcester, which is not Wales, obviously, but, you know, we can see Wales from where we are. And where else did you go?
And then I took the train down to Anglesey. I'm not going to try and pronounce it by its proper name. I'm really sorry to all of our Welsh listeners. Which is, again, a fascinating seat because it is notionally a Labour-plied Cymru marginal. But the interesting third force there is UKIP, because they are taking away white working class votes from Labour. So Plaid Cymru could actually have a fairly bad night in terms of the popular vote around Wales, but still pick up a seat if some of that doesn't go back to Labour.
And how well generally are UKIP doing in Wales?
Yeah, really well, actually. They have this slight problem, as one sort of Welsh Conservative put it to me, they're taking our activists, but they're taking Labour's votes. And that means in some places their activists and their voters are not geographically convenient for them. But they are, they actually have a fairly serious strategy on the ground. They're building sort of population centres, because in the Welsh elections, because it's a list system, you don't need to worry about wasted votes. You can just rack up as many votes in your core areas. And I suspect that a lot of safe Labour seats in Wales will have a strong UKIP presence in second. And in some places, you will get a sort of eating away of the Labour vote. Because the interesting thing in Wales, I talked to Roger Scully, who is the expert on Welsh politics and Welsh voting behaviour. People who live in sort of Essex or Chingford who sort of switched to the Conservatives in the 80s, that never really happened in Wales. But that is the demographic which is most inclined to vote for UKIP now. So basically what's happening in Wales now is that bit of the Labour vote, which is actually quite socially conservative, has fairly strong views about benefit claimants, is now starting to be won over by another party, but it's not the Conservatives, it's UKIP.
That's interesting. And then the other question that kind of we always come to when we talk about Welsh politics is we're looking at an election that is, if anything, the big surprise for most people has been the rise of Scottish nationalism, the incredible surge in support for the SNP, both in terms of their activist base and in terms of the fact that now most projections putting them on around 50 seats in Scotland. Plaid Cymru, I think it's fair to say, this is not the Plaid moment. As you say, they might pick up an extra seat, but why is there less allure for Plaid Cymru than there is for the SNP?
I mean, it's a combination of factors. The interesting thing is, in the first elections to the devolved parliament, Plaid actually did better than the SNP. They got a higher share of the vote. They've been unluckier in their opponents. The Welsh Labour Party has, with the exception of Alan Michael, the first leader in Wales, has been very good at defining itself as individually Welsh. Carwyn Jones, in the words of one insider, has wrapped himself in the flag, which sort of means that Plaid Cymru doesn't have that sort of cultural nationalism, that civic nationalism the SNP has. They're sort of stuck with the language and the economy. The economy, the Welsh economy is not an argument you want to be making if you're arguing for independence. And the language, they sort of have two disadvantages. One, it is a much less visceral political dividing line than it once was. Their Plaid's activists are no longer the subject of sort of prejudice or attacks because of the language and sort of a.
And is that because that's been sort of the? I think there's been a kind of movement by the bourgeoisie to really reclaim the language. It's become a very intellectual pursuit as well as a grassroots movement. And it has been. I mean, there have been huge amounts of money has been spent on initiatives and putting signage and everything being. I mean, has that sort of essentially then diffused that as a nationalist argument?
Yeah, I think. So in another way, I'm about to put my head in the lion's mouth here. I think their big problem as a movement is one, a lot of people I spoke to talked about them in the same way that sort of non-practicing or reform Jews in the area I'm from talk about the Orthodox community in Stoke Newington. They don't want to be like them. They don't want to have to sort of get into that fairly serious question. But they're very glad that they're there. But the problem is, it's quite difficult to build a movement out if people are glad and you're there but don't want to be like you. And also, because they do have legitimate grievances, the north of Wales is, getting to it via public transport was like crossing the Arctic, is completely cut off from the prosperous South, and more importantly, is cut off from places like Chester and Liverpool, which really should be the engines of growth for the North of Wales. But because those are concrete grievances, if you can't build out from a concrete grievance because you don't share it, you're sort of stuck as a political party. Because the SNP's grievance is sort of, you know, you can kind of pick. There's sort of something for everyone there. They have that capacity to be a broad movement.
That's interesting. So, yeah, the idea that there isn't a there aren't good motorway links in is in some ways a much more tangible thing you think you'd be able to build a campaign around. But because it only affects people who don't have the motorway, it's not that pressing an issue to people in Cardiff. I suppose that's the problem, isn't it? It's not something that everybody can feel that they can sign up and sort of be subsumed in. Do you foresee any surprises in Wales on election night?
A couple. Cardiff Central, which on paper is one of the easiest Labour pickups, student-facing, you know, young population, etc., etc. The Liberals look very well dug in there. They are privately very bullish. Labour are privately very pessimistic about it. Whereas the Vale, which on paper, if it was in England, would be a safe Tory seat. It's a majority of 6,000, I think. So it's one of the more ambitious targets. Labour is backing it very hard in terms of resources, and they are competing even in sort of the most affluent parts of the seat. Otherwise, I think, Anglesey is one to watch. Labour ought not to have any difficulty there, but it's easy to see how Plaid will come through the middle. I think the main thing to watch, and the big trend, regardless of who ends up in office in terms of how the Labour Parliamentary Party thinks about things, will be these UKIP second places throughout the north, throughout Wales. You will have Labour MPs who will probably be a distant second, but psychologically will feel that, these Eurosceptic anti-immigration party are, right behind their heels. And that will be the big change in the mentality of the Labour Party.
Thank you very much, Stephen. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.